Good evening and welcome to tonight's telephone town hall with the Natural Resources Council of Maine and the NRDC Action Fund. My name is Lisa Pullman, Executive Director for the Natural Resources Council of Maine, and we are Maine's leading environmental advocacy nonprofit organization. I'm going to be your moderator for tonight's event, and we'll be joined by Maine Senator Angus King to discuss our environment and what NRCM, the NRDC Action Fund, and the Senate are doing to push back on environmental rollbacks coming from the Trump administration and his allies in Congress. So thanks so much for joining us tonight. Now, before we begin, a few quick points. Right now, we're dialing out to thousands of environmentalists across Maine. So just stay on the line, and we'll be hearing from Senator King soon. Also, this telephone town hall is for you. If you'd like to ask Senator King or any of our speakers a question tonight, please press 0 on your telephone keypad. Again, press 0 at any time, and you'll be connected directly with one of our volunteer operators who will register your question. So, while we wait for more people to join, we'd like to ask you all a question that you can respond to using your telephone keypad. We'll ask a few questions like this tonight. So here we go. The first question. How soon do you believe climate change will have impacts on Maine? Press 1 if you believe impacts are already underway from climate. Press 2 if you believe impacts will not be felt until 10 or 20 years from now. And press 3 if you believe climate change impacts are not a serious risk to Maine at all. So once again, how soon do you believe climate change will have impacts on Maine? Press 1 if you believe impacts are already underway. Press 2 if you believe impacts will not be felt until 10 to 20 years from now. And press 3 if you believe climate change impacts are not a serious risk to Maine at all. While we wait for you to respond, I'd like to once again welcome you to tonight's telephone town hall with the Natural Resources Council of Maine and the NRDC Action Fund. This is Lisa Pullman, Executive Director for NRCM. I'm your moderator for tonight's event, and we'll be joined by Maine Senator Angus King to discuss our environment and what the Natural Resources Council of Maine, the NRDC Action Fund, and the Senator are doing to push back on environmental rollbacks coming from the Trump administration and his allies in Congress. So we thank you so much for joining us tonight. And before we begin, just a few quick points. We're in the process of dialing thousands of activists across Maine, so just stay on the line. We'll be hearing from Senator King shortly. We want to hear from you, so if you'd like to ask a question of Senator King at any point during this event, please press 0. Again, press 0 at any time, and you'll be connected directly with one of our volunteer operators. So now, while we're waiting, we are just checking on the results of the first poll question that we did, which says that impacts are already way. 94% of the people who responded believe that there are impacts already under the way from climate. 3% believe that impacts will not be felt for another 10 to 20 years, and 3% believe that climate change impacts are not a serious risk to Maine. We'll have a couple more of those questions in a while, and we'll wait just another moment for people to join. If you've just tuned in, welcome to tonight's Natural Resources Council of Maine and NRDC Action Fund telephone town hall with Senator Angus King. We'll hear from Senator King in just a moment, but I want to remind you that if you'd like to ask a question of the senator, simply press 0 on your phone, and you'll be connected to a volunteer operator who will register your question. So with that, let me just say again, this is Lisa Pullman, Executive Director of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. We're Maine's leading environmental advocacy organization. And as Mainers, you know that for a number of years, we have been fighting back at the state level against attempts to roll back the safeguards for our land, air, and water. Fortunately, we have been largely successful in blocking them with your help, but now we're dealing with a lot of issues with the Trump administration. And tonight, we're providing you an opportunity to speak to one of our most important decision makers in Congress, Senator Angus King. First, though, I'd like to introduce NRDC Action Fund Executive Director Kevin Curtis, the co-sponsor of tonight's event. Kevin.
Kevin, are you there?
We've lost Kevin.
Oh. Well,
sorry.
Thanks,
Lisa. It's a pleasure to join so many dedicated folks who are interested in protecting our environment. My name is Kevin Curtis, and I am the executive director of the NRDC Action Fund, who also is clearly technologically challenged on the mute button, so I apologize for that. We are the C4 affiliate of the NRDC Natural Resources Defense Council, one of the country's largest environmental groups with more than 3 million members and activists, including many in Maine. We are proud to partner with NRCM and to support Senator King in this teletown hall, because quite frankly, we need teletown halls like this in Maine and around the country, because Washington, D.C. is not being good for the protection of our environment, including that in Maine. So with no further ado, let me turn the call back to Lisa, and so we can get to Senator King. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. We're going to hear from Senator King very soon, but right now I want to remind our listeners that this telephone town hall is all about you. You can press zero at any time to ask a question. And as I mentioned before, we're also going to have a series of poll questions tonight that you can participate in by simply using your telephone keypad. We're going to go into a question right now, again, simply using the numbers on your keypad to participate. So here's the second poll question. What environmental issues are of most concern to you? Press 1 if it's pollution of drinking water. Press 2 if it's pollution of lakes, rivers, and streams. Press 3 if it's air pollution. Press 4 if it's climate change. And press 5 if it's extinction of plant and animal species. One more time, here's the question. What environmental issues are of most concern to you? Press 1 if it's pollution of drinking water. Press 2 if it's pollution of lakes, rivers, and streams. Press 3 if it's air pollution. Press 4 if it's climate change. And press 5 if it's extinction of plant and animal species. So I'm seeing the results come in. We're almost there. I think I'll get back to you about that, but for now, what I'd like to do is bring on Senator Angus King, who has served as the independent junior United States Senator from Maine since 2013. Please welcome Senator Angus King.
Hey, Lisa, thank you so much, and thanks to Kevin for putting this opportunity together. I'm delighted to be able to spend some time with you all, and we've been working together for many, many years. Probably we don't want to really count, but I go back with the Natural Resources Council to about 1970 when Bill Townsend took me to a meeting down in Augusta at the old City Hall. So it's great to be back with you and to be able to answer some questions. We're under assault, frankly, on a lot of fronts in terms of environmental protection down here, and unfortunately that means that in many cases we're playing defense instead of trying to deal actively with some of these issues, but we're on the right side of history, and we just have to keep our eye on the goal and keep pushing. And I can tell you that the activism and engagement of people in Maine and across the country is ultimately what's going to make the difference. So I don't want to make a long speech. Why don't I stop there? And Lisa, you can start passing on the questions.
Great. Thank you so much. So here's a question from Carol Wanborough from Portland. I hope I got your name pronounced correctly. And the question is, how does the senator believe we can reject or prohibit offshore drilling in Maine?
Well, that's a very timely question. I was really happy that yesterday, without a lot of fanfare, that Susan Collins and Shelley Pingree and Bruce Poliquin and I, in other words, the whole Maine delegation, made a very strong statement saying this isn't good for Maine, it's not something we want to do, and we made it very clear from the point of view of the Maine delegation that this isn't the direction that we think makes sense. I mean, what I said in an immediate statement was the cost to Maine of any kind of incident involving drilling off our coast far outweigh any potential benefit. And now the next step is that about an hour ago, we put in a bill that basically would prohibit offshore drilling anywhere off the coast of New England. And I'm not sure who has signed on to this. I know Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island, I think the Massachusetts delegation, Jack Reed of Rhode Island, I'm not sure about Connecticut, I suspect they will sign on. So hopefully that will be a legislative statement that will strengthen the direct statement that we made. I think it's important that, I don't know if you heard this, but they exempted Florida this morning, basically saying because Florida's coastline is so, tourism is so important. Well, our coastline is pretty important to us too, and it seems to me the same argument would apply. So, and then finally, there is an opportunity for public input. The Interior Department, which is sponsoring this, I think not a good idea, is having a public meeting on Monday the 22nd, a couple of weeks from now, from 3 to 7 at the Augusta Civic Center. And that's will be an opportunity for people across Maine to go in and register their concerns, make their concerns known. I think, Lisa, that's an important day. It's Monday, January 22nd, 3 to 7. At the Augusta Civic Center. So this is an all-hands-on-deck proposition as far as I'm concerned, and I certainly am going to be engaged in it from here on out, and I hope you'll join me.
Thank you, Senator, and thanks for such a great question. Just to remind everybody else, you can have your question asked too. Just press 0 on your telephone keypad to speak with one of our volunteer operators. So the next question is from Alan Armstrong from Portland. Senator, how can we get a national price on carbon?
Well, elections have consequences. It's going to be very difficult now with this administration because they don't recognize the danger of climate change, and I don't think they view this as an important issue. I mean, just the fact that we left the Paris Accord is an example of that. I think it's, but here's the way sometimes these things work. You work on something for months and months and sometimes years and years, and then all of a sudden a moment comes when it happens. There's a kind of tipping point. And I think part of it is to maintain the discussion, to keep the discussion going, and I'll tell you where I am on this issue. I understand exactly the logic of putting a price on carbon and being sure that we're paying for the externalities as well as just the usefulness, but politically we've got to be sure that whatever we do has a refund mechanism that's pretty much immediate, that people will see, because if they go to the pump and gas is suddenly $5 a gallon and they get a refund a year later, I don't think that's going to work. I think people have to you have to understand people are pretty distrustful of politicians. And And if we say, well, we're going to put on this big tax, but don't worry, we'll give it back to you, I think they're going to need some, it's going to have to be some immediate thing. I don't know whether it's a reduction in the FICA tax or a monthly check or something. The other piece of this that I'm encouraged by is the costs of renewables are dropping so fast that the differential between carbon-based fuels and renewables is getting to be less and less, and renewables are going to be competitive with or without a price on carbon. That certainly happened, the dramatic reduction in solar panels, and I think the next frontier is a similar reduction in battery technology so that we have the storage to back up solar and wind. So I think, you know, how do we do it? We keep the pressure on, we keep talking about it, but we also take advantage of developments in technology that render it less important if indeed renewables are fully competitive, then the market will take care of it itself.
Right. Thank you. So we have a question from Norma Dreyfus, and it's not exactly clear where she's from, but she's from Maine. And her question is, what can we do about the state of the EPA? And she notes that the staff is demoralized, and Scott Pruitt, who is the head of the EPA right now, is launching attacks regularly. So, Senator, what would you have to say about that?
Well, it's terrible. I voted against Scott Pruitt without any hesitation. Every now and then we have votes around here that are hard, that you have to sort of agonize over. This wasn't one of them. This was as easy a no as I've ever cast. I mean, my standard is if somebody's been nominated to run an agency who's fundamentally hostile to the mission of the agency, that's an easy no vote. Same reason I voted against Betsy DeVos. There is a ray of hope. As you know, the administration's budget proposed about a 31% cut in funding for the EPA. The good news is the Senate appropriations bill funds 98% of the budget. In other words, instead of a 31% cut, there's a 2% cut. I wish there ought to be an increase, not a cut, but in any case, that's a big improvement. In other words, Congress isn't going to go along with these cuts, I don't believe. The House allowed more cuts, so that's something that's going to have to be responded to and resolved, but the Senate, anyway, is pretty strong in supporting the mission of the agency. In terms of what the caller asked, though, about morale and the loss of professional staff, that's a real problem, and that's going to be something that will be felt for years. As we lose good people, and it's not a place to work that people can feel a sense of mission, that is in some ways as serious as the budget cuts. Elections are what matter in the long run, and we need people in Congress in 2 years from now, and we need an administration that cares about these issues. And it's really I can understand what the people at the EPA feel. It's got to be disheartening to have dedicated your life to issues like climate change and environmental protection, clean water, clean air, and to see it under constant attack. As I say, I want to leave you with something positive, that at least on the Senate side, we're not buying those proposed cuts.
Yeah, that's good to hear, Senator. So Donald from Bucksport, this is also about drilling, just in a different place. He asks, what is your position on drilling in ANWR, that's the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and how can we block it?
Well, there's another easy one. I'm dead against it. I voted against it on the floor. I voted against it in committee. And I got to tell you, I listened. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is the chair of the committee. I work with and know Dan Sullivan, who's the other senator from Alaska. I listened to their case. We had a hearing on it. They brought in experts both on pro and con. And in the end, it just didn't make sense. There's a lot of land up there. There's a huge national petroleum reserve that's available for drilling. And the idea that it has to be in this one relatively small 1.7 million acre parcel out of a state that's 370 million acres in total, it just doesn't make sense. I think if there's good news there, it appears that nobody's going to do it. They took some bids for drilling in the petroleum reserve. They came out much lower than people expected. There weren't many bidders. And at least at the current price of oil, I think it's unlikely, and this isn't a guarantee, but I think it's fair to say it's reasonably unlikely that it will be, that any drilling or even exploration will take place in the immediate future. But it did pass. I mean, it was in that terrible tax bill that passed at the end of in December, so it's in the law that not only does it say they may do leases, it says they shall do leases within this provision. And I'll tell you the piece that really bothered me. It was represented that this was only 2,000 acres, that it was limited to 2,000 acres. Well, if somebody tells you that you think of a contiguous 2,000-acre postage stamp in the middle of this great big area. It turns out that that 2,000 acres of impact is measuring the square footage of each pod of the pipeline and the size of the drill rig. In other words, it's like saying that 100 chairs in a room only fill up 5 square feet because you only measure their feet on the rug. You don't measure the whole chair, and that's what they and that when I realized that, that was one of the things that really I said, you guys better quit using this because it's misleading and it doesn't help your case. So the short answer is it passed in the tax bill. We're not clear. It's not clear whether anybody's going to take them up on it. I hope they don't. We can hope that at some future date we can reverse this dreadful decision.
Yeah, so sort of same topic but different angle. Jonathan Malmoud from Limerick asks, how does the senator think we might best deal with the increasing problem of tick-borne diseases in Maine, especially since they now have both Lyme disease and other diseases connected to them? So,
well, it's a real problem, and it's getting more serious, and I think it relates to climate change. It has to do, in part, with warmer temperatures, and this is a real problem with moose and with deer. I was up in Acadia this summer, at the end of the summer, with some entomologists looking at work that they're doing to try to study this project and how we can prevent this and contain this epidemic. The other piece, frankly, is medical research. CDC and NIH, because tick-borne diseases are becoming much more prevalent. Lyme disease is a real problem. I know people, kids, teenagers, who have been afflicted by it, and it's really of the debilitating disease. So it's in part an offshoot of climate change. I think medical research has got to be part of it. Awareness. One problem with Lyme disease is it's often misdiagnosed. People don't pick it up until it's advanced, and we need to educate people as to what the signs are and how to detect it early, because it's much easier to treat when it's treated early than late. But so that would be my thought. But that's a good question. I remember Jonathan from my days in Augusta.
These are all great questions. And just a reminder to everybody, if you have a question, you can dial 0 on your pad and you'll speak to a volunteer operator who will record it. So here's a question from Richard in Gorham. What is being done to ensure that our drinking water will remain drinkable? How can we avoid a Flint, Michigan?
Well, you know, the Flint, Michigan issue was based upon their infrastructure rather than the water itself. It wasn't anything in the water. It was the pipes and an old infrastructure. And I think that's something that we have to pay attention to. We have to pay attention to where the lead is in our pipes in Maine. We all need to test it. Maine has one of the highest percentages of people who get their water from wells of any state in the country. So people need to be careful and be sure that their wells are good. They ought to have them tested. I think that's part of the answer. There's a revolving drinking water fund, and I'm an advocate for continuing to fund that. I don't think it's adequately funded. This is a huge problem nationwide. I'm not sure it's as serious in Maine as it is other places. But I remember Bob Casey, the senator from Pennsylvania, saying there were something like 15 cities in Pennsylvania that had water as bad as Flint, particularly the older urban centers with pipes that go back into the 1890s and early 1900s. So I think testing to find out what the problem is one of them. And, of course, the story of the Natural Resources Council and other environmental organizations started with the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and paying attention to the quality of water, and that involves everything from air pollution, which ends up in the water, water pollution, water treatment, dioxin. By the way, Lisa, I'm sitting about 10 feet from Edmund Muskie's desk. The
right.
desk in my
I
office belonged to Edmund Muskie, and I think we can say with some assurance that the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act were at least in part written at that desk. Pat Doak, who's my office administrator, found the desk in storage, and it's a reminder to me every day of the legacy of Edmund Muskie, and it's also pretty daunting, I can tell you, to look at that desk and realize that one of the real giants of the environmental movement in this country came from Maine, came from a town with a big problem of water and air pollution, and tackled it head on and really did a great deal to protect the environment of the country.
So that's such a good example of what one person can do. There's a lot of people on the phone and a lot of people across Maine and all over the country who are trying to figure out how to have an impact. And Bob from Nobleboro asks, what can the individual do to have an impact at the national level? What you're hearing from lots of people, Senator, what's having an impact?
Well, let me go from the particular to the general. The particular, for example, would be to go to that public meeting of the Interior Department in Augusta on January 22nd and register your thinking about offshore drilling. That's a case where if there's an overwhelming number of people and an overwhelming number of comments, it's going to make a difference. It's going to have an impact on that particular issue. It's going to make it harder for the Interior Department with a straight face to say this is something that we need to do or should do off the coast of Maine. So there's a particular case. I think the other thing is people often feel that those of us in Washington are somehow insulated or isolated. Public opinion matters. People registering, people who write my office, who send emails, who call, I see that data. I know what people are concerned about. And it definitely has an influence. I mean, a good example, and I don't want to take a lot of time, but if you remember the healthcare vote last summer, where Susan Collins and I both voted no on the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, I'm convinced, in Susan's case, for example, that public opinion had a real impact. She was listening to, the people of Maine, and we do that. It does matter. So, and then of course, again, I keep coming back to this, voting matters. The Virginia legislature, we just had a vote down there, which was in the news. You may have seen it, where there was one seat that was decided that was actually a tie, and they drew straws to decide who got the seat. And because the Republican won the lot, that tipped this balance in the Virginia legislature. So one vote, I'm glad I don't live in that district and didn't vote. I couldn't sleep at night. One vote really can make a difference. So public engagement is, and what we're seeing now with the EPA and all the things we've been talking about are the results of the presidential election. So that's the most direct way that we can make a difference, and it matters.
That's great. I'm sure everybody's listening. I know we have a lot of active people on the phone. Here's a good question from Bill Hensley in Lewiston. He asks, so he states, electric cars are starting to become more and more popular. I just bought a Nissan Leaf this year. Do you foresee extending the electric vehicle tax credit for future years, and how can the state of Maine add incentives for electric vehicles?
Well, I can't really speak to the state incentives. That's up to the legislature and the governor. I can tell you that the electric car incentive was in the crosshairs of the tax bill. And in fact, I think in the House version was eliminated. It got put back in the Senate version and was preserved. So as bad as that bill was, at least this is a place where it didn't make things worse. And I can't resist telling you that my Nissan Leaf is down in the garage being charged right now. I have a Nissan Leaf that I use down here. My license plate is a Maine license plate, and it says on it, no gas. So if you're in Washington and you see a little silver car that says no gas, you'll know who it is. But I think that's the wave of the future. I think electric cars are really important. And again, this incentive is important. But there'll be a time when it will no longer be necessary, because I think the technology will continue to improve to the point where they're going to be perfectly competitive with fossil fuel cars. And of course, people like Volvo and I think Toyota has said that as of 4 or 5 years from now, they're not going to make any more straight fossil fuel cars. They're going to be all hybrids or all electric. Volvo has said they're going to go to all electric in 2 or 3 years. So it's where the future is, and I really like my my Leaf. It does everything I need to do, and I don't know what the effective mileage is. It's probably the equivalent of about 120 miles to a gallon. And you can't put a price on feeling so smart when you drive around not using gasoline.
Right. Staying in the Twin Cities for just a moment, Chris Carson of Auburn asks, what does Senator Kaine think about the National Flood Insurance Program? In particular, do you think the program is sustainable as the climate begins to change?
I'm not an expert in this area, but I don't think it is sustainable. I think as we're going to see more and more coastal flooding, the strain is going to be more, the premiums are going to be more people are going to be affected. I think it's something that we're really going to have to look hard at in terms of how it works. And it's a difficult public policy issue because if you put all the cost on coastal residents, it's going to be very, very expensive. On the other hand, people in Iowa argue, why should my taxpayer the money go to subsidize somebody's insurance in Georgia or Maine or Florida? So it's a very tough public policy issue, but I think the answer to the caller's question is that I don't think it's sustainable as it's currently structured. One problem we've had in Maine is with the maps. The FEMA maps have tended to not be very accurate, and people find themselves in a floodplain paying for flood insurance when they really shouldn't be there. So there's a lot of work to be done to be sure that we're accurately assessing this. But, you know, as we move into an area of sea level rise, which I think is inevitable, it's really the real question is, do we act now to mitigate it, or do we do nothing and then it's going to be a real disaster? But I think we're at a place now where there will be sea level rise. It's going to be an important issue, particularly in places in Maine that are more on the tidal marsh, Scarborough Marsh, and down along the south coast. It's going to be a serious issue. I don't think it's going to stand the way it is now. It's one that Congress is going to have to tackle.
Yeah, so Senator, you mentioned that you did not support Scott Pruitt's nomination. However, you did support Ryan Zinke's nomination. And Ann from Waldo wants to know, are you disappointed that you voted to support that nomination based on what's happened?
Well, yes and no. I'm disappointed on the offshore drilling proposal. On the other hand, I'm happy that his recommendations essentially left the Katahdin Woods Monument intact. He did not recommend reducing it in size or eliminating it or substantially modifying it. And I think that's a good result for Maine. And that's something that at the time of his nomination was very much front and center. And it was something that we were all very concerned about. I certainly was. And let me share, I'll be honest with you, how senators sometimes make these decisions. As I mentioned, if I felt that someone was genuinely opposed to the mission of the agency, like Scott Pruitt or Betsy DeVos, that was an easy no. If someone is simply not the person you would have chosen, that's a little bit different. And the other piece was, and this goes for Mr. Perry as well as Ryan Zinke, if they were going to be confirmed anyway, which they were, I didn't want them to start the job with a negative feeling toward the senators from Maine. That's just being pragmatic. I wanted them to return my phone calls and share my concerns. And indeed, I've had a lot of conversations with Ryan Zinke about the monument. He's been very responsive and I think responsible in the way he approached that. The other piece with him that didn't get much publicity is, and he and I talked about this before he was voted on, he was one of the few Western congressmen who is in favor of the maintenance of federal land ownership in the West. a lot of the congressional people from the West want to turn that land over to the states or sell it off for private use. And he has been, when he was a member of Congress from Montana, one of the few that was steadfastly opposed to that. And I thought that was important and an indication of his priorities. Do I agree with him on the offshore drilling? No. Do I agree with him on everything? No. But I made a judgment that I wanted to be able to work with him, particularly on an issue of paramount importance to Maine, the monument. And I think that was we escaped largely unscathed on that. Of course, we don't have the final word from the White House or how that's actually finally going to come out. But he listened. He came to Maine at my request. He visited the area. He talked to people up there. And so the answer to the question is, do I regret the vote? No. Will I disagree with things that he does? Absolutely.
Okay. Just a reminder to everybody, if you have a question, you can press 0 on your phone, and one of our volunteer operators will record it. Here's a question from Ray Peck in Northport. He asks, what do you see as far as the state of wind energy in Maine? Is there an opportunity for that industry to expand?
Well, you know, that's really a state and local issue. As you know, I worked in the wind power industry back about 10, you know, almost exactly 10 years ago. And having worked there, it really depends on the location. There are places where wind power makes sense and works and is appropriate and doesn't disturb the neighbors and is far enough from neighboring houses, and there are other places where it can be a problem for people who live too close. It really depends on the siting of the project. I think there are areas where there's significant potential, but a lot of them are up north where there isn't the transmission capacity to get the power out. Out of Arista County, for example. So, you know, this is really a matter of a kind of case-by-case analysis. I don't think you can say it's all good or it's all bad. I think it makes sense. I think the thing that I concluded, and I know the wind energy has divided the environmental community to some extent, the one thing I've learned, I've worked in hydro, biomass, conservation, and wind in my lifetime. And what I've learned is there's no free lunch when it comes to energy, that there are costs and benefits to whatever the alternative is. And if we say we don't want hydro on the rivers or we don't want wind, then we're saying yes to nuclear or natural gas or something else. There are always trade-offs to be had. But I think there is additional potential for wind in Maine, but I think the best way to do it is the way Maine does it, which is case by case, site by site. Oh, by the way, before I forget,
yeah.
I do want to mention that the really huge wind potential in Maine is offshore.
Yeah.
That's where the winds are more sustained, that the winds are higher, and although there are conflicts with fishermen and we have to work those out, but I think we can, there is huge potential for New England, and if Maine doesn't do it, someone else will. Massachusetts is actively soliciting offshore wind capacity right now. The University of Maine Aquaventus program is one of the most creative in the world in terms of it's the only real floating platform that I think has long-term economic potential. So I think this is something we've got to look at. I think it would be important for the economy. Very important for energy. Let me just, in the last month, we all know how cold it's been. I have a little app on my phone. Anybody can get it. I urge you all to download it. It's called ISO2Go. ISO2Go. And it is a real-time report from the independent system operator, the ISO, that runs the whole grid in New England. And you can look at it, and it tells you, number one, what the price of wholesale power is at any given moment. And by the way, it's almost always lowest in Maine of anywhere in New England. But secondly, it tells you where the power's coming from. And during this period of really cold weather, you know where we've been getting a lot of our power? Oil. Cousins Island has been running for the last month. It's the first time I can remember it running, and that's not a good thing for the environment. That's not a good thing for anybody. So we've really got to think about what are our alternatives, and what can we be doing that will avoid the use of a big oil plant. And offshore wind is something that has to be in the discussion.
Good. Just again to remind people, if you have a question, you can press 0 on your phone and speak to a volunteer operator. We're going to switch back from climate change to water here. Carl from Waldoboro asks if you could explain the path forward to protect the Clean Water Rule and protecting isolated streams and wetlands as a result.
Well, that's a really good question because the EPA is not exactly supportive of the Clean Water Rule that was promulgated. I was very involved in that. I had Gina McCarthy, the head of the EPA, come to Maine. We met with a group of farmers and citizens. I did a lot of work with the farmers because they were concerned about what the impacts were. But right now, I'm not sure the exact status of the rule of whether they're going to roll it back or not implement it, but it's a problem. I mean, this is it's a classic situation where we have to have regulation, we have to protect clean water, we have to protect these intermittent streams, and we have to protect the streams that connect to the other streams that ending up in our rivers. On the other hand, we have to respect the interests of people like farmers and others who are work in the adjacent to these streams. And I think one of the most important things about the rule is how it's implemented. And I think the jury is out about what this EPA is going to do and whether they're going to backtrack entirely or whether they're going to implement it in part. But it's certainly something that we have to pay attention to. I mean, the questioner didn't ask, but the other big question here is the clean power plant. And that, I think, was a very important piece of environmental regulation that is being rolled back, which I think is really unfortunate. And, we're trying to slow down the march of history here. We're moving toward a renewable future. We're moving toward electric cars. We're moving toward more efficient use of the grid. And really what's happening now in many ways among some of these, leaving the Paris Climate Accord or repealing the Clean Power Plan are really, I consider, rear guard actions. They're going to hurt us for a time. Ultimately, I don't think it's not going to be sustainable because people are going to realize we've simply got to protect this precious environment. And in Maine, the environment is really our most important asset. It's what keeps us here. It's what brings people here to visit us. Many of our most important industries and businesses are based upon environmental quality, and it's inseparable from who we are as a state.
Right. So there are several questions here. I think there are numerous people on the phone who are involved with young people or worried about young people. I think most of us probably are. So I'm going to put several together. One is from Peter Scott in Yarmouth, who asks how you think we can engage young people in environmental issues. He worries that young people are feeling disempowered about the way things are. There's somebody else who noted that the current Trump administration is so anti-environmental, what's going to be left for future generations? And then there was Laurel Sewell from Phippsburg who says she's organizing a group of students and faculty to do letter writing around environmental protection. What would you say is the most effective ways we can approach that and topics we might address? So that's kind of putting a bunch of things together having to do with getting young people involved.
Well, I'll add to that. I do something here. We nicknamed it Capital Classroom, where about once a month or once every 6 weeks, I do a live video conference with a Maine high school. And today, as a matter of fact, I had about almost an hour with Karabek High School, which is up around Emden and North Anson and that area, and talked to their students. And they asked, interestingly, they asked a similar question. One student said, how can I make a difference? And, of course, young people are inherently idealistic. They want to make a difference. And in Maine, they can. I told this young man, I said, find out who's running for the legislature in your community and go to work for them, be a volunteer, get involved in their campaign, go to see them in Augusta. We're, you know, you know Lisa and Pete is there and Dylan and others that the Maine legislature is ridiculously accessible. I mean,
right.
You know, there are no offices, there are no closed doors. You can go up and talk to people. And I think young people need to be encouraged to engage, also to vote. I mean, frankly, young people tend not to vote in as large numbers as older people. People over 70, I think 70% of them vote. People under 25, 40% or 30% vote. So young people need to be encouraged to participate so their voices, so politicians worry about them. Think about what they're interested in. The other thing is young people can take on local projects and make a difference in their community. I know a young woman named Chloe Maxman who I think she lives in Nobleboro or Waldoboro or one of the towns up near Damariscotta. And when she was in high school, she led a drive to get rid of plastic bags in her town. And they won. They got it done, and it was spearheaded by kids in the high school. And I think young people really like specific projects like that where they can see some results. So I think there's a lot of work to do. I think the young people of Maine are ready, willing, and able to do it, and they need all they need is some encouragement and leadership and guidance. And, you know, one way would be to get involved with your local legislator. Another way would be to take on a project in your community. I think there's a lot that can be done, but we need to encourage them because generally their instincts are pretty good.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. So Christina from Portland has a question that sort of crosses both state and federal boundaries. What is your position on public transportation, and how can we expand public transportation in Maine? Knowing that much public transportation is federally funded, I'd be curious what you had to say about that.
Well, you're talking to a guy who spent 8 years literally getting the Downeaster done. That was a real long struggle, and it started just about the time I entered being governor, and I smashed a bottle of champagne on the first train down in Boston in the year 2000, I think it was, or 2001. So I'm a great believer in public transportation. The problem in Maine, and there may be some solutions to this, but the problem generally is that public transportation requires density. In order for a bus or a train system to work, you've got to have enough passengers to make it make sense. I think we may be to a time where technology, where it may not be a train or a huge 40-passenger bus, but there may be more in the way of vans that people can summon electronically, and they can pull together an economic load of passengers to go from Lewiston to Portland or Augusta to Waterville, and it might make sense. But I think we need to be realistic and understand that the challenge of public transportation in rural areas is serious because there just isn't enough passenger density to make it work. The Downeaster, as you know, has been expanded to Brunswick, and this summer they're talking about taking it to Rockland, I believe, which I think is pretty cool. But you have to have the passengers. Here's another piece that is, I think, very, very important. Broadband and telecommuting. Not having to physically go from Emden to Skowhegan to work. If you can work from home, and that involves having really good broadband, which is one of our great problems in Maine and a problem across the country in rural areas. One of my big pushes in the next several months, there's all this talk down here about infrastructure, and one of my, I almost said obsessions, is maybe not, I mean that's too much, but one of my strongest priorities is to see that anything we do on infrastructure specifically involves broadband. That it's not just tucked in with bridges and roads, but that broadband is treated as important infrastructure that's essential for the 21st century. So that's one way that we can bring people together in terms of work and knowledge and information without having to have them drive. I'm very interested. We've got a lot of people in Maine, for example, who are now working from home, who work for Unum or Anthem or some of our other major businesses, and they work from home. They don't have to drive. They don't have to use fossil fuels. They don't have to have transportation. And I think this is going to be something that's going to grow and be much more important in the future. So public transportation is absolutely essential. It's something we have to continue to work on. It does involve subsidies. It does involve government payments, whether they're federal or local. But I think it is important. And the Downeaster is a good example. The Downeaster has one of the highest riderships in the country of any Amtrak train. And it's a wonderful, any of you who haven't ever taken the Downeaster to Boston, it's really fun. It's a long, skinny Maine town. I guarantee you get on that train and start walking between cars, you're going to run into somebody you know. And it's just a wonderful experience. And hopefully we are going to be able to spread that, make that go all the way to Rockland. And there may be an opportunity to take a train service up to Divide at Portland and go up to Lewiston. But it's a challenge because of the density, but I think it's something we have to keep, we absolutely have to keep working at.
So, Senator, we have, I think, time for a couple more questions, though there's quite a few in the queue, but there's Diana Young from Bangor wanted to know, what does the future of tidal power hold, and why did it not get going earlier?
Well, the answer is because it's technologically tough. And you know, one of the greatest tidal power projects in the country almost happened in Maine in the 30s. The Bay of Fundy tidal project that Franklin D. Roosevelt supported, it ultimately didn't happen, but the potential tidal power is gigantic. But it's hard to capture that energy. There's a company that's based in Maine that's been doing a lot of work over the past 10 years on tidal power in Eastport, and they're also working in Alaska. There are a lot of people working on the technology of it, and the challenge is to develop an underwater turbine that captures sufficient energy and can withstand the forces, and the forces of the tide and icing and salt water and corrosion and all of those things, and yet at the same time be affordable in terms of the cost of producing power. But tidal power is definitely, it's one of those things that I think in the right place at the right time is going to be one of our assets.
So I'm going to swing back to the answer to the poll question that I put out earlier in this conversation. The question was, what environmental issues are of most concern to you? Climate change topped the charts at 55% of the people who answered said that was the most important. Then there was a tie for pollution of drinking water and pollution of lakes, rivers, and streams. The next one was extinction of plants and animal species at 13%, followed by air pollution at 8%. But just to focus for a second on that extinction of plant and animal species, there have been quite a few comments, and I'd just like to pose to you, Senator, these attacks on the Endangered Species Act. What do you think about that, and where do you think we should go on that?
Well, I'm a supporter of the Endangered Species Act. It's been one of the most successful environmental pieces of legislation in our history. I would put it up there with the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And I think I don't see any need for significant change. The controversy often comes when you have a situation like in the upper Midwest, I think it's Wisconsin, where they've reintroduced a wolf population, and the question is, when are they strong enough to be taken off the list? And that's often a contentious issue. Many of the Western senators are very worried about the Western sage grouse, and that, believe it or not, that came up, I think, this year in the National Defense Bill. We had to fight it off. You should have seen John McCain. He was fit to be tied when he had to deal with the Western sage grouse in the Defense Bill. But I think fundamentally the law is sound, and I haven't seen any proposals for changes that I thought would be beneficial. I do think, you know, we're going to have to, again, take the issues become when is a species sufficiently recovered in order to be protected. And because the one thing about the Endangered Species Act is it's a very, very strong law, and its protections are very, very heavy. And so I think we need to be careful and not use it frivolously. It's got to be used for serious cases, because we don't want to undermine public support for it by applying it in cases where it really isn't totally necessary. I think, you know, my answer on practically all of these questions is, let's go back to the science. That's how we should be making these decisions. What's the science tell us? What are the risks? What are the dangers? What are the impacts of any of these questions? And to me, you know, every now and then I ask myself, Angus, what is your philosophy? And my philosophy is what works. Practical, science-based, pragmatic, what's good for the environment and for the public. And that's the way I've always tried to make these decisions. So I don't think, Lisa, that you're going to see significant changes to the Endangered Species Act. There will be forays every now and then. I think there may be some danger of regulatory changes that would undermine it to some extent. But that's about what I see at this point.
Great. So I need to start wrapping things up, and I just want everyone to know that this conversation doesn't end tonight. If we didn't have time to get to your question, or if you have additional questions for the senator, you can visit Senator King's website at www.king.senate.gov to submit your question there. Just mention you were on the telephone town hall. If you have a question for one of tonight's sponsoring organizations, either NRCM or NRDC Action Fund, you can stay on the line to leave us a voicemail. Even if you don't have a question, we still want to hear from you. Please stay on the line to leave us a voicemail message about why it's important to you that we stop Trump's big polluter agenda, frankly. And please remember to state your name and where you're calling from in your message. We might share your thoughts with legislators, media, or put it on our website or social media. So I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. Citizens like you make such a difference when you take the time to stay informed and take action. That's what's made the Natural Resources Council of Maine successful for 60 years. And Kevin, would you like to just say a quick farewell?
Yes, thank you, Lisa. It's been great to partner with a wonderful organization like the Natural Resources Council of Maine on this call and in this work. I hope everyone has enjoyed the discussion with the senator. I certainly have. It's reminded me, quite frankly, how wonderful Maine is. Part of my job is to do lots of calls like this, and Maine just stands out, and the quality of this conversation just stands out. I want to thank Senator King for joining us tonight and also for his hard work in the Senate. Now more than ever, we need the senator's help to stop the attacks on our environment coming from President Trump and his allies in Congress. And to close, as Senator King noted, the single best way to protect the environment this year is to vote and to get all your friends to vote. So thank you, Senator. Thank you, Lisa. And thank you all for joining us on this call. Senator?
Senator King, did you have one, you know, we give you 30 seconds to close if you'd like.
A U.S. senator can't clear his throat in 30 seconds, Lisa. No, I'm just kidding. This has been great, and a quick invitation. Anybody from Maine that's in Washington on a Wednesday morning, we have coffee and the most wonderful blueberry cake you ever had in our office. We'd love to have people from Maine come and visit. I'm here. The staff is here. We'd love to have you come down and see us. Keep in touch with the office. Ideas are the most valuable thing you can provide. Pass the ideas on, and I'll look forward to seeing you around on the street. I understand that since I came down the other day, it's warmed up a little bit, but we'll see more of winter. But it's been great, Lisa. Thanks very much. I appreciate it. And what you all proved tonight by the calls and the questions is how much people care in Maine, and that's what it's all about. Thanks so much.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this call. And for more information about how can you help to push back against the Trump administration, please visit nrcm.org or nrdcactionfund.org. We want to thank Senator King for taking time for this call and thank all of you for joining us. Have a great night.